Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin, and it's stage number two of my conversation with legendary car owner, 2010 May Motorsports Hall of Famer, Beech Ridge Hall of Famer, Dave Cudamarsh. In stage one, we learn where Dave came from, all sorts of urban renewal, his humble beginnings as a driver, and what led him to become a car owner. Now, this time out, we get into something I think that Dave is most known for, I mean, depending on your time at Beech Ridge, the Super Modified division, and his teaming with Ralph Cusack for their multiple track titles, one of which almost didn't happen for them. Matter of fact, the title basically belonged to someone else, and we'll get into that story on what happened in the late 70s. Also, Dave tells a quite humorous story about driving from Green to Scarborough, which is about 50, 55 miles, in a bus, an old school bus, without any brakes, including a trip on the main turnpike. And we also get into the later stages of Beech Ridge on Clay, and this stage will take us right up through the mid-80s. Before we get into today's content, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for contributing to Open Trailer Podcast via Patreon. It's patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast. One-time donation, or if you decide to become a Patreon member, where you contribute a certain amount every single month, one of the bonuses that you'll get is early access to our episodes. You'll also get an Open Trailer Podcast sticker. By the way, that's still, if I haven't got yours yet, it's coming. Believe me, it's not lost on how fun it is to package something up and just say thanks for listening and send off a sticker. Something as simple as that, really. I'm about as basic as they come, so. Things like that amuse me. Well, I wouldn't say amuse me, just it just feels really good to be able to do that. One thing I didn't mention in episode one is Maine Vintage Race Car Association. You can see the MVRCA sticker or logo on the truck of the Open Trailer Podcast logo. This project started as a companion piece to what we were doing in Maine Vintage Race Car Association. It's still an amazing organization. We're both pulling for the same team here. We're trying to get the word out, preserve history, so make sure you support them by becoming a member or showing up at one of their events. And, you know, warm bodies from someone who's been there and experienced it. The biggest way that you can help Maine Vintage Race Car Association is just show up to one of their meetings and be an active participant in preserving history. So with that, let's get into stage number two of Dave Cudamarsh on Open Trailer Podcast. That's great. Do you know how many races you won together?
Ralph and I?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I think we won 20 Super Modified races.
You won three championships in that Super Modified. But there was one that you almost didn't win. And that was the year that Jeff Stevens had the field covered. Can you tell me that? Tell me about that year.
Well, you know, after we watched Jeff with that car, I believe he bought it. It was a former Oswego car, and that was the year we took the wings off, and the modified started to run with us.
Traditional modifieds, as we know.
Traditional modifieds, which we were going to the next year. But I mean, Jeff was so smart in buying that car, and he was such a great driver and stuff. The rest of our cars really didn't go well with the wings off because they were made to run with a wing.
Okay. Why would they take the wings off?
They wanted to slow them down so the modifieds would be competitive and, you know, to encourage people to build a modified that year.
Was track management up front with what was going to happen?
Yep, very. Calvin Reynolds owned it at the time. He came to the meeting at the Buxton schoolhouse there where we always met and everything and told us what his plan was for the next year and that we had to take the wings off the Supers and that was going to be the final year of them and stuff.
Did the drivers have any say? Was it?
Yeah, they were still Maine State Stock Car Racing Association sanctioned the races, you know. But Calvin you know, we knew it was going to happen one way or the other. That's the direction he wanted us to head in. But so, after we saw Jeff drive for a few weeks with that car, like Wally Prescott was always a guy that was right up front in the points, and Ralph was, and Phil, and you know, and Dick Walsenhume and stuff. We said, we're all racing for second. There's no way that we're going to beat Jeff. And Jeff rolled off 14 feature wins that year.
How come he didn't win the championship, though?
Well, Labor Day weekend, Jeff doesn't show up at the races at Beechridge. And we said, what's going on? And as somebody said, well, Jeff's racing at Oswego. And there's been a rule in the rule book for, you know, forever about you can't race at another racetrack when Beechridge is having an event. That was a main state stock car rule, not Calvin Reynolds, you know.
And Main State Stock Car Racing Association, they work together with the racetracks.
That's correct.
To promote. So I assume that they would take certainly a cut of the grandstand. So that would mean that they're invested in the stars that people show up to see. So that's probably why there was that guarantee there. Like if I am growing up a Ralph Cusack fan, or a, you know, Homer Drew fan, I don't have the internet because the internet doesn't exist. I know that I'm going to show up to the racetrack and see my driver. And if I don't, then I'm going to be disappointed.
Yes.
That's probably why that was in the place.
And that Beechridge wasn't Main State Stock Car, and Beechridge wasn't the only track that tried to keep their all their drivers at home. You know what I mean?
Is that why Jeff became the outlaw? Because he would just do whatever the hell he wanted to do whenever he wanted to do it?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, Ralph and I got along great with Jeff. We never had any problems with him. Realized what a great driver was. I mean, he drove for Clyde Booth down to Star. He had one of the top super modified rides there was. But going, I mean, to that season, I mean, that was his championship to lose. He had it won. There was none of the rest of us going to beat him. We knew that. We were going to finish second, third, fourth, however it ended up, you know?
Yeah. So I'm looking at some of these point totals, too. How does Ralph Cusack get 15,000 points throughout the season?
Well, in 75, they started the multiplier system in the points. You know, you got, at that time, I think you got like 33 points to win the feature, let's say. They had various point systems over the years, but then they started multiplying it times the number of times you raced there.
So that buys into the last thing where, you know, there were driver guarantees or, you know, you couldn't race any other place. Another incentive for the driver is you show up and then they multiply your points based on the number of times you show up.
Correct. And there was 27 to 28 race meets. So, and then unfortunately, Jeff had that horrendous accident down the front stretch with his super when he did come back the next week to race with us.
Do you remember seeing that?
Just from the pit, so I didn't have a good view of it. I don't really know how it started, but
so he goes over. He's on the front stretch and he hits the wall basically head on. And you know, maybe you can see pictures. Certainly, they're on the internet of the car suspended in the air upside down. And he's got the open face helmet, and he walked away from that incident.
He did. Jeff was in great shape, though. He was he was really in great shape.
Tell me a Jeff Stevens story that you don't think anybody's heard.
Oh gosh,
it's a podcast. It's not a broadcast. We don't have the FCC breathing down our throat.
I don't know. Everybody just knew. Don't.
He was a wild man. Right?
He was a great driver, but he was a wild man, and. Yeah, well, and you know, I don't know if winning a championship meant anything to Jeff. He had never won one anywhere else. I mean, he went fast enough and won all kinds of races, but I'm not sure it was that important to him. I think it was more like he loved to win races, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, he seems like he was, I don't want to say Tim Richmond before Tim Richmond, but he was, you know, definitely, he earned the term outlaw, you know, where he was he'd race anything. He was super, super fast, but he also had a temper too, and don't mess with Jeff Stevens.
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess I just thought of a story though. This is years afterwards, and we're in Florida, and I'm at Kissimmee to a car show there at Old Town and stuff, and there's this huge, it was an Oldsmobile or you know, a Pontiac convertible sitting there, and a nice one. And I'll be darned if it isn't Jeff's car, you know, and stuff. Yeah. We're talking away, and Jeff never said, that was probably the first time I had seen him since he stopped, you know, after the Super Modifieds at Beechridge. And I says, I says, Jeff, where are you staying down here or anything? He says, Disneyland.
Just the most family-friendly place on earth, right? By a person who wasn't known for that. Yeah. Wow. So speaking of family, tell me about your family and the role that they played in your race team throughout, you know, the 70s. Which we're still on because you have a young family. You mentioned your first daughter came along in 68. Your other daughter came along in 70, 71. 70. So, I mean, did they grow up at the racetrack with you?
They did. And to travel together for a while, my wife had a 71 Suburban. She drove down there and stuff. But then we got a school bus, and Ralph helped us buy that. Mm. It actually came out of the North, the Wyndham School Department, where Chummy Brown took care of the buses up there. Mm. And that school bus was really, the kids loved riding on that school bus. And the other guys, the two guys that helped me then, Brian Collins and Wes Rogers, and Bill York helped me. But the first two, their kids came to the races every week on that school bus. Now, I'm not sure if they didn't like the school bus more than they liked the races, right. You know.
How many people do you get on the school bus at once?
20, 22.
Really?
And still put the car in the back.
How did you manage that?
We built a wall halfway in the school bus, you know, cut the back end of the bus out.
And that's legal, right?
I guess we didn't ask.
All right.
But no, that bus, we must have run that, I don't know, 8 or 9 years we ran that bus while the kids were little and stuff.
Just back and forth to Beechridge, or did you go elsewhere?
Oh, that bus went to Stafford. It went to Thompson. It went over to Monadnock. Yeah. And it would only go like 58 miles an hour.
So,
it was an old Ford with a 330 in it, with a 5-speed and a 2-speed rear axle.
Yeah, with a bunch of mechanics that certainly work on it, so it never had any mechanical issues on the highway, did it?
So one night we're coming down, I was living in Green at the time, we get down into Lewiston, going across the bridge there into Auburn, and I lost the brakes.
Ooh, and for those that don't know the lay of the land, that's a pretty steep hill.
And so I got this handbrake down on the floor, and I'm gearing the thing down, right? And right. I got it stopped, you know, before I got all around to Center Street. I said, what the heck are we going to do? Get the hammer out, rolled underneath it, and it was a rusted brake line. We hammered the thing shut. And I says, we can't be late to the races. My wife says, why? We're still going to the races? You don't have any brakes.
You don't have any brakes.
I says, I got a handbrake over here, and I can pump the brakes up now, I think, a little bit. I couldn't. It never did help any.
Wait a minute. You went from Lewiston to Scarborough on the highway?
Yeah.
No brakes?
No brakes. Right down the main turnpike. with a load of mothers and mechanics and the kids all in there. Everybody's...
Wow. That's living on the edge.
Yeah. And that shows you how important it was for us to get to the races. It was what we did. I mean, we never owned any boats or motorcycles or anything. You know, we just couldn't afford it. The money went into the race cars. And
How many, after your service concluded in 1972, how many races did you miss throughout the rest of your time as a car owner?
The only year that I missed, we were there all the time for, you know, until 1990 when the modifieds were done at Beechridge. During the fall of 1986, I had been director of maintenance for Sanborn's Motor Express in Scarborough, and they got sold to APA Transmitter in North Bergen, New Jersey. And that next year, I spent so much time down in New Jersey and Philly and down that way that I just couldn't have a race car. That was the only time I really had to. Finally, there was a reason I had to give up racing for a year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 87 is the second year Beechridge is paved, and the 61 car is not there. Were there a lot of rumors of why it wasn't there, or was it well known that you just had work things to do?
Yeah, I think I'd made it known that it was work commitments. Mm. Yeah.
going back a few years, you know, yes. You mentioned Mike Rowe was your driver. You'd steal him from time to time. There's a photo circulating where his hand is bloody from winning the race.
Yeah, he came down with Butch Craig's late model from Oxford, and the windshield actually caved in on his hand during the first. There was twin 50s. The windshield came back on Mike's hand, and he's bleeding away and stuff. So he finishes the first 50, and Butch got it back together somehow. There was other things that were broke, too, like a shock and a few other things. Mm. Got it fixed, and he went back out, and of course he won the next 50 race.
In your car?
No, but he also drove my car that night and won in the modified feature. And that, okay, but I believe it was earlier in that year, he came down from the Coke 100, and he drove my modified in the Coke 100 and won that over Ricky Zemler was second and Homer was third. That was a great race. And he also talked Butch into bringing his late model down, and he won with the late model. So both times he came to Beechridge in 1981, he won both features.
Wow. So 81 is the first year that Ralph Cusack owned Beechridge. He retired from racing right before then. Was he still driving your car at that point?
He drove my car right up till 1980, the season before. And I believe Ralph won seven or eight features that year in 1980. But he won the last three features that season in a row. And he was also voted most popular driver that year after all them years of racing. And I thought I still had him there and stuff. You know, I didn't know at that point that he was buying the racetrack.
Really?
No.
When did that conversation happen?
It happened in the spring with me. There may have been other people that knew, yeah. And so I said, who am I going to get to drive this car that's going to follow in Ralph's footsteps? You know, and I'd been spoiled because he hardly wrecked anything. I mean, there was one bad accident in there one night when he was leading the Coke 100, you know, and the yellow came out, and the second place car didn't know the yellow come out. We ended up in the backstretch wall, but that was totally not his fault.
Right.
And there was one other really bad night during the super modifieds to go back. Ralph and Jerry Dolliver are racing side by side down the backstretch. Jerry Dolliver's driving the 76, and somebody pushed Bob Libby out of the pits. I'm sure Bob didn't know that the race is under green because he came right down across the racetrack, and that isn't something he would have done. He would have stayed on the top of the racetrack. All three cars rolled over in a knot there.
Jeez.
And, of course, that was of a Saturday night of a double weekend. But we got it put back together. We got ours put back together. The 76 didn't come back for a few weeks.
Do you guys sleep at all that night?
Not. We never went to bed at all.
Wow.
And I'll tell you how good the people were back then about loaning stuff. I didn't have a spare wing. And I call Wally Prescott, and I says, do you have a spare wing? And he says, yeah, I'll bring it up with me, Dave. I'll have it. And Wally finished in the top three in points for all 5 years the Supers were there. If he probably hadn't lent us that wing the race that night, the championship might have been gone for us because it was always tight between us.
Yeah, that's wild. So how does that conversation with you and Ralph go? Obviously he told you.
Called me and told me, he says, it looks like it's going to go through. He says, I hate to say it, but, you know.
What do you mean? What's going to go through? You had no idea.
No, I had no idea at all. Maybe some other people, you know.
Right.
But I wasn't paying attention. I didn't know. And I was devastated. I mean, it was just huge.
Hmm.
So the first one that came to my mind that I liked a lot, he pitted beside us, was Larry Lasky. And I called Larry Lasky about taking Ralph's place, and Larry says, let me talk it over with the family. And he called me back in a night or two later, and he says, you know, this has always been a family deal for me down here, and I don't think he wanted maybe the pressure of following Ralph. I don't know that. But
I wouldn't want that.
You know.
Most popular driver, won the last three races, 12-track championships, you know. How do you follow Richard Petty?
Yeah, and so I call Ralph back and I says, do you know anybody else that Ralph? And he says, well, this young Tommy Oliver that's running in the limiteds, he says, it's pretty good. I says, I don't know if I want to start with somebody, but it was like maybe 2 weeks before the races were going to start. And it was close because Tommy had his limited all ready to go.
Did you know Tom at all?
I did not know him at all.
You had to cold call
him? Zero. Yeah, I did.
Wow.
And he jumped at it and stuff. And I, in hindsight, looking back, I got to say, you know, Tommy did a good job in there. He had some things he did I didn't like. He was good to work with. There was not a problem there.
Mm.
And that was the year I brought Mike down twice, and I pulled Tommy out of the car, and I put Tommy in my spare car. I had...
Right. The 16?
Yeah, the 16 car.
Where did the 16 come from?
We started... Kurt Bells, who built the motors for the Super Modifieds, my Supers, and maintained them for me, said to me, Dave, you know, for 79 when the Modifieds died, he says, Jesus, I'd like to drive a Modified. He says, oh, boy. So we looked around, and we found one down that had been barely raced at Riverside Park. Don DeRocher owned it, and it was extremely straight. And so we bought that really right, and it came with a spare frame to boot. So it was a good buy. So, you know, it was a slow process for Kurt to pick up because, I don't know, maybe he raced something before, but I'm not sure he ever did and stuff. But I says, I sure don't want to lose him either. I want to keep him interested enough because he did such a good job of my motors and saved me a fortune. But that's how I ended up, that's how I had a spare car.
Mm. Is that the one that Glenn Cusack wrecked on the backstretch?
The Pinto that Ralph drove was actually the one that Glenn wrecked so bad. Yeah, that was in 85. Larry Tangway had been driving for me after the 81 season.
Did Tommy only drive for you 1 year?
Just 1 year.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had a chance to, at the end of that year, the reason that I got impressed with Larry Tangway, because I really didn't know Larry either. I mean, he'd been there a long time. He had a good record and stuff. But he had his own stuff, too, so I didn't really think he'd be honest. But he blew the motor in the V8 one night, and he came over, and he says, sorry, I wasn't using the 16. It was there. And he says, any chance I could drive that for the feature and get some driver's points? You know, because back then, I don't know how they did it at the end, but back then there was driver's points and there was owner's points. You know, and that's how an owner could finish ahead of a driver or vice versa, you know, at the end of the year. It made it confusing, actually. Mm. And so he takes that thing out there, and he finished third in the feature with it. He never practiced with it at all, you know. And I said, wow. And Ralph hated that car. It was a leaf spring car in the rear, and it never sat. He says, it just sits on top of the racetrack. And Ralph had to drive it after we had that bad crash down the backstretch during that Coke 100. I think Ralph had to drive that for maybe 4 or 5 weeks while we got a new clip onto the Pinto. But that's kind of opened my eyes to Larry. And that, boy, when I got him into the Pinto in 80, the start of 82, wow, he was way better than I ever could have dreamed of. I mean, he had back-to-back years in 82 and 83 where he won 8 features.
What is the core sponsorship come into play?
Well, in, let's see, 1982, it was with Larry. It actually started with Cumberland York Distributors in Portland, and it came to us with the Stroh's sponsorship to begin with. Do you remember when the dog commercials were on TV and the dog went to the refrigerator and the guy's watching the football game and you brought him a beer?
Yeah. Boy, the 80s were wild. We actually convinced the population that it was okay for dogs to drink beer. His name was Alex. Alex from Stroh's. But yeah, so I remember Stroh's very well.
Yeah. Well, I had them for 2 years, and when those dog commercials disappeared, so did the sales.
Oh.
And I says... I remember the guy called me from Cumberland York, and he says, well, he says, the Stroh's deal's going to end because what they gave me, Stroh's matched, okay?
Hmm.
And then he says, but the good news is Coors Light is really becoming a big hit here in the Northeast, he says. So we're going to switch you over to them. And it became better. I had them for 7 years, and it became better. It slowly increased.
Hmm. Were they, not to dispel a myth, maybe you can reinforce it, but the idea is that there was a lot of money behind this race car with Coors, big national sponsorship all over a local car.
Well, I don't mind saying it certainly was a big help, because I can only think of one $400 sponsorship, Saco Motors, that we had before that. And I think it was on the car for two or three years for that original $400. And the, you know, the cars that have been redone since then all still have that on there. So they probably got their money's worth by now. But anyways, that the Stroh's deal started at $750 that first year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they were so happy with me at the end of the, happy with us at the end of that year, that they doubled it to $1,500.
Would they pay you in product as well?
And yes, they did.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, the way I paid my crew.
Fueled by beer.
Right. We did have all the free beer. They were very generous with that.
Well, how many cases of beer would you go through a week?
Well, if my wife stopped by, they just really load up the back, whatever was.
They bring that big bus if it's 26 people. Would you bring the bus to the distributor?
I don't think the bus was ever over there.
Oh, okay. It's a good thing.
Yeah. They were a bad image with the kids. You know?
Yeah, you wouldn't have won that many races probably.
No. Yeah. But no, they were wonderful. And I got to say, but it came when it switched to Coors. Coors had one rule that they gave to me. They said, Dave, we know your cars win races over there in championships, and you do the car show stuff that we like. You know, we always went down to Race-O-Rama with the car, you know, and, you know, we did a World of Wheels show and various things like that. They liked that because it was really the amount of money they told me that they give you is on how many people see the car every week, you know. And if you say, you know, 4,000 at Beech Ridge, you know, it's not a big enough number, but like Race-O-Rama, supposedly it was 25, 30,000 people went there for that. So that was very important. But anyways, the rule, they said, Dave, the one rule that we're going to enforce with you is don't do anything that would ever embarrass us. And he says, make sure you tell your guys, your crew guys, and we expect you to be dressed good, and the cars have got to look good.
You were one of the first teams to wear matching uniforms. Was that part of the
absolutely
presentation?
Yeah. Yeah, originally, I think my wife might have had some homemade stuff before that. But, yeah, and actually the Coors clothes came from them for free.
So when you would have somebody new on the crew, you would say, okay, we have this great race team, but we have a couple of rules. You can't get out of line.
Absolutely. And I had to do that with the drivers, too. You know, I says, you know, we can't afford to blow this deal, you know, if that money wasn't coming in, it'd be coming out of Sandy Nye's pocket. You know, she was a school teacher and I was truck maintenance guy.
So mid-80s, you know, before Beech Ridge changes over to asphalt, how much is the race team spending per year to stay competitive and win races?
That's really – I wish I had thought about that. I don't know. I don't think we ever spent over – $10,000-$12,000 a year, because we had years we darn near broke even when Main State Stock Car, because we got 50% of the front gate, you know, made up the purse. If you won on the right night, you like the 4th of July or something, that was a really good purse.
Because your winnings would fluctuate based on the number of people who show up.
That's right.
Wow.
Yep, we got 50% of the front gate and $1 off every ticket in the back gate.
Wow, that's quite the hookup.
And it's much like Danbury Fair Race Arena had the same thing. You know, they had a racing association down there that sanctioned the races.
Why did that dissolve? It seems like a really good deal.
It dissolved when Main State Stock Car stopped sanctioning the races and Ralph took over.
Oh, okay.
And he came out with a guaranteed purse, you know, with $1,000 to win in the
modified. So you didn't have the guaranteed purse back then?
No. Okay. Nope. No. We've won features there that paid $200, you know, on a bad
foggy night. Yeah. Actually, you know, it's funny, just to backtrack a little bit. During the pre-interview, we talked about the super modifieds, and, you know, you blew my mind with how technical these race cars were in the late 70s, and the fact that the weather played a big role in the performance of the engine. Can you expand on that?
Well, I had an excellent guy, Kurt Bells, that built those motors, and he actually worked for me at my garage also, and later on he stayed with me at the first trucking company I worked for. And he was really an ace on, we almost had like a weather station there. Because of Beech Ridge especially, you'd see the sea fog coming in some nights there. And we'd have to determine before the start of the feature, there was a pill in the fuel return line, much like a jet in a carburetor or whatever, but it determined the amount of fuel that was returned to the tank and stuff. And he was just an ace at setting that. I mean, you had to know, you had the temperature and the humidity and the just the way the conditions were going to go. Because those things, they typically did not give us enough pace laps for them to warm up. You couldn't start them up in the pits because they were direct drive. So they push us out there and want to give us the green flag if that bank of fog's going on, you know, and the things are popping and all this and that, and because, you know, it was alcohol.
Where would you get your gas?
For a long time, we got that fuel, the alcohol, from Ronnie's Fuel Service that did Star Speedway at the same time, and then I figured out what it was, and I bought it from a chemical company right in Auburn.
Do you tell anybody you did that?
I don't think so.
No.
You could. There was no rule. I mean, you weren't supposed to mix something more into it like the drag races were. But, you know, it was a lot of work to keep that system clean because if you didn't clean the nozzles every week and if you left it in the lines and everything, stuff turned to powder during the week. And you just saw more people. I remember even Dick Bergen Gore was his crew chief. He was an engineer, for gosh sakes, and they got into some terrible fuel problems. You know, I think Dick might even have won a championship one year there if they hadn't got so bogged down with their fuel problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's the 70s, the romance. I think a lot of us, you know, when we look in the rearview mirror, we're like, oh, yeah, you know, we used to just work on the race car one night a week or we'd pull it out of the snow pile, you know, and go to town in April. But you guys had to work on that race car nearly every night.
Well, I'll tell you, that engine in the Super, that was a 60 over 427. It was an L88. It was, the top, most powerful engine at the time. And, you know, and we, of course, we'd changed the pistons in it. So it even had probably like 14 to 1 compression. And, the valve covers had to come off and we tested the valve spring pressure every week, you know, and really watched the keepers and make sure it wasn't sucking the keeper. There was a lot of maintenance to that.
How much does your trucking background go into, I mean, because trucking, obviously big motors, how much does that carry over into super modified?
I think a lot because I was director of maintenance for 3 different trucking companies at different times after my garage business. And, you know, that was what the trucking companies paid me for, was to keep their trucks running without breaking down. And so, you know, we had the wheels off that all the time, repacking wheel bearings, and Kurt did the engine stuff. You know, we just knew that you could only run quick change gears so long before they got fragile. And
now, does everybody else know this?
I'm not sure that if you didn't work as a mechanic, you might not have been as up to date. And, you know, the old A-class guys, you didn't have to do that much maintenance on them. And they were much more basic than the Supers. Mm. I think that might have been that probably was the failure of the super modified class, why it didn't grow. You know, it was always in the 16, 18 car area.
How fast were you guys going around the track?
Well, everybody thinks that the Supers were faster, but actually the modifieds after the place was paved were faster. The track record, Bobby Gahan held a track record at 14.7 with the modifieds. And the rest of us, you know, ran in that area all the time. But Bobby put 2 laps back-to-back, so we always got the credit for it, which is fine. Bobby's a great guy to race against.
Well, Bobby ended up driving for you towards the end of the clay days at Beech Ridge because, you know, the times that Bobby Gahan put down were in the asphalt days, but
right.
You know, supers are turning that time during the old clay surface with, you know, the ruts here and there. Tell me about the last days of Beech Ridge on clay, because you had a different driver.
Yeah, Larry. The 1985, Larry Tangway started the season, and he was working for Bruce Elder part-time, driving Dozer, and he drove a pin out of the Dozer blade to angle it. and a chunk of steel come off that and went right through his eye.
Oof.
And so I lost Larry 2 weeks into the 85 season, and Bobby Turner had been driving my spare car, which was the Pinto at the time, and for the first 2 weeks. So I says, geez, what am I going to do? Well, Bobby's right here. You know, he's got a ton of experience and stuff. You know, and Sandy and I just had to say to Bobby, you know, Bobby always made fun of it. Bobby, we want you to win, but we can't get into any trouble. There's this sponsorship. It says Coors on the side of it. So so if you get mad at anybody, don't do it here. You know?
Well, that's funny. I mean, I hadn't thought of that until just now. Bobby, may he rest in peace, just one of the most wonderful characters to roam the pits at Beech Ridge in the history of the place. But to tell Bobby Turner not to get into mischief, boy, that's a tall order. He had to want to win really bad.
I got to tell you, we laughed all year, and Bobby did such a fantastic job. Bobby won 8 features that year, and he missed winning the championship by just a little bit, and it was really my fault. 2 or 3 weeks from the end of the year, the Panhard bar broke with about 5 laps to go in the feature, right? And Gahan had already fallen out that night. His spur gear has broken the rear end. And so we would have passed Bobby and Bobby Gahan in points that night, but the Panhard broke and we didn't finish either.
Wow.
But one of the things that Bobby Turner, you know, goes down on his resume, he won the last 3 races, modified races, run on the dirt at Beech Ridge Speedway in 1985.
When does word come down to the competitors that they're going to go asphalt the next year?
I don't remember me knowing it.
So the last race that you raced in 85, you didn't know it was going to be asphalt?
Maybe I did. Maybe I did, because I guess they got started on that right away after. I think they did. You're right. They got started on it right away.
Yeah, just to insert my experience in that, and I'm just thinking of it now too. I remember going down on the racetrack that night with my dad, and I actually slipped and fell on the racetrack, and I put my hand down. And the weirdest thing, if I'm lying, I'm dying. I remember saying, "Boy, I'm really glad it's clay," you know, because I had heard that they were going to make an asphalt, you know, and I guess we knew because they dug it up right after that. Now, how was that met by, well, someone like yourself, who was, you know, a top team owner and built that amount of success over the course of the years, that they're going to change the recipe for 86?
Well, you know what? The guys like myself that had been there for a long time had a big advantage over anybody coming in from outside for a while, because we knew how to read that clay. And lots of times after the heat races, I'd go out and cut a piece out of it there at the 3 turn and see how far it was soaked down into the dirt, and whether it was going to go dry during the feature. Or
how often would they re-oil the track?
I think pretty much they used Bunker C on that, number 6 oil, but I think back in once in a while they didn't have any of that, and they'd put some thin oil on it, and that didn't last, and it didn't hold it together either.
Why would they oil the track instead of just running it flat dirt?
It would have been so dirty if they hadn't have done that.
Okay, so it was a fan thing?
And
entertainment?
Yeah. And you know, I think the race, that was my favorite years, racing on when it was dirt there. It really was, because I just think if you really tried hard, you could figure that out. And I had Ralph. Of course, Ralph knew what the track, you know, when the track changed, where to race and stuff. And so it gave us a little advantage there. But the big thing, I think, the big change when the dirt left and the asphalt came was the tire bill. We used to only buy about 8 or 10 tires a year during the Supers. We ran those Firestone Big Jelonis, the treaded tires.
Yeah.
And We'd grind them some and sipe them, you know, to keep them getting down into fresh rubber, but they just didn't wear out. We were spoiled with how our tire bill was so small. And that's eventually when the asphalt modified started there. You know, that's why we went to first the 2-tire-a-week rule, and then we got it down so it was only putting 1 tire on a week.
Just for cost savings?
Just to save cost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with that, we wrap up stage number two of Dave Cudamarsh on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. And yes, there is an episode number three, or stage number three, to Dave Cudamarsh, which, by the way, is next. We've talked a lot about the highs of modified racing, specifically at Beech Ridge Motor Speedway, but anyone who was around at the time knows that it wasn't all fun and games, and all good things must come to an end.
Well, it was 1990, of course, and we'd had the driver that died on the front stretch wall in a modified, you know, and then Lou Weatherby got hurt real bad bouncing off the front stretch wall and stuff, and I think that was Ralph and Jane, I just think, were so worried. And the modifieds everywhere, you know, we just lost a whole bunch of modified drivers. And we all made the mistake of making the front clip so sturdy that when it hit something, all you did is had to put some steering pads back on the right front, but the frame was all right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the driver took all of that pressure.
That's only one of the stories you'll hear next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. Thank you for your support. Can't wait for stage number three.